I heard you were back from your journey and brought a woman with you, he called out, running up. I'd like to meet her. His speech had a strange impediment that Ayla couldn't quite place. Then she realized he spoke somewhat like a child, but with a man's voice. He had a lisp. Jandalar looked up and frowned. The man was not someone he was particularly happy to see. In fact, it was the one person of all the Zelandanyi that he hoped he would not see, and he did not like the assumed friendliness. But he felt he had no choice but to make the introduction.
Ayla of the Mamutoi, this is Ladraman of the Ninth Cave, he said, not realizing that he had introduced her with her former status.
Jandalar's voice was as neutral as he could make it, but Ayla immediately detected the disapproving undertone and glanced at him. The tension of his jaw showed he was just short of gritting his teeth, and the stiff, unwelcoming posture gave her further clues that this was not someone he was pleased to see. The man held out both hands and smiled, showing his two missing front teeth as he moved toward her. She thought she knew who he might be, but the empty space in the front of his mouth confirmed it. This was the man Jandalar had fought with. Jandalar had hit this man and knocked out those two front teeth. As a result, Jandalar had had to leave the Ninth Cave and went to live with Dalinar for a while, which, as it turned out, was probably the best thing that could have happened. It gave him a chance to get to know the man of his hearth and to learn the skill he ultimately grew to love, napping flint, from the one who was acknowledged the best. Ayla had learned enough about the tattooed facial markings to realize that the man was an acolyte, training to become a Zelandani. Then, to her surprise, she felt Wolf brush against her leg as he moved forward to put himself between her and the stranger, and she heard his low, warning growl. The only time the wolf ever did that was when he felt she was threatened. Maybe he's sensing Jandalar's stiffness and rejection, she thought, but for some reason, Wolf did not like this man either. The man hesitated, stepping back, his eyes opened wide with fear.
"Wolf, stay back," she said in Mamutoi as she stepped ahead to respond to the formal greeting. "I greet you, Ladraman of the Ninth Cave."
She took both his hands. They were damp.
"It's not Ladraman anymore, or the Ninth Cave. I am Madraman of the Fifth Cave of the Zelandanyi now, and an acolyte in the Zelandania. You are welcome here, Ayla of the..." What was that name? Mutani, he said, watching the wolf, whose growl had increased in volume.
He immediately let go of her hands. He had noticed her accent, but the wolf had so disconcerted him he hardly paid attention.
"And she is not Ayla of the Mamutoi anymore, Madraman," Joharan corrected. "She is now Ayla of the Ninth Cave of the Zelandanyi." "You've been accepted by the Zelandanyi already? Well, Mamuto or Zelandanyi, I'm glad we happened to meet, but I have to go to a meeting now," he said, backing away as fast as he could. He turned around and almost ran back the way he had come.
Ayla looked at the two brothers. They were grinning with almost identical smiles. Joharan saw a group of the people he was looking for. Zelandani was among them. She motioned the three over, but it was the fourth, Wolf, who got most of the attention. Ayla signaled him back while formal introductions were made. She didn't know if he would react to someone else the way he had to Madraman. Several people were surprised when the foreign woman with the strange accent was introduced as Zelandanyi, formerly Mamutoi. But it was explained that since there was no question about where she would live after she and Jandalar were mated, the Ninth Cave had already accepted her. The most important decision, other than deciding to mate, was whether the man would live with the woman's people, or if the woman would go to live with his. In either case, acceptance by both caves was necessary, but most especially by the people who would have a new member living with them. Because they knew where Jandalar and Ayla would live, the Ninth Cave's acceptance of her settled the matter. Ayla kept the wolf close while she and Jandalar listened to the secular and spiritual leaders discuss plans.
It was decided to have a ceremony the following night to find out the best direction to go for the first hunt. If all went well, the first matrimonial would be held not long after. Ayla had learned that there were always two matrimonials each summer. The first was to mate those couples, usually from the same region, who had decided to mate during the previous winter. The second was held shortly before they left in the fall. Most of those couples were from more widespread caves who made their decision during the summer meeting, perhaps having met only that year or a season or two before.
"Speaking of the matrimonial," Jondalar said, "I would like to make a request. Since Dalinar is the man of my hearth, and he is planning to come, I would like to ask if the first ceremony can be delayed until he arrives. I would like to have him here for my mating."
"I wouldn't object to a delay of a few days. But what if Dalinar doesn't come until much later?" Azelandani asked.
"I would prefer to mate during the first ceremony, but if Dalinar is delayed too long, I would be willing to wait for the second. I would like him to be present when we're joined,"
Jondalar said. "That's acceptable," the Zelandani who was first said. "But I think we have to decide just how long we can hold off the first matrimonial, and that depends on the others who want to mate now." An older woman with Zelandani markings on her face rushed to join them.
"I understand Dalinar and the Lanzadani will be joining us this season," she said to Joharin. "He sent a messenger to Zelandani of the 19th, since they're the closest to the summer meeting campsite, to let everyone know. The daughter of his mate is to be joined this summer, and he wants a full matrimonial for her. I understand that he would like to find a danyer for his people. This could be a real opportunity for an experienced acolyte or new Zelandani."
"Jondalar told us Zelandani of the 14th,
Joharin said.
"That's one reason he's bringing his Lanzadani here this year," Jondalar explained. "They don't have a healer, although Jerrica has some knowledge, and they don't have anyone to perform ceremonies for them. He doesn't feel they can hold a proper matrimonial until they have a danyer of their own. We visited on our way here. Joplea promised while we were there. She is going to mate with Echazar."
"Dalinar is going to allow Joplea to mate a man whose mother was a flathead? A man of mixed spirits?"
Zelandani of the 14th interrupted.
"How could he do that? His own daughter! I know Dalinar has accepted some unusual people into his cave, but how can he take in those animals?"
"They are not animals," Ayla said, frowning in anger at the woman. Chapter 23. The woman turned to look at Ayla, surprised that the newcomer had spoken out, and even more, that she had contradicted her so brazenly.
"It is not your place to speak," she said. "It is not your concern what we say at this meeting. You are a visitor here, not even Zelandani."
She knew the foreign woman was supposed to become the mate of Jondalar, but she apparently needed to be corrected and to learn proper behavior. "Forgive me, Zelandani of the 14th, the one who was first interjected. "Ayla was introduced to the others. I should have introduced you to her when you first came. Actually, Ayla is Zelandani. The 9th cave accepted her before we left."
The woman turned toward the first, and her hostility was almost palpable.
Ayla discerned that the animosity was of long-standing, and she recalled something about a Zelandani who had expected to be named first, but was passed over in favor of Zelandani of the 9th. She guessed this was the one.
"Ayla and Jondalar tell us flatheads are people, not animals. I think it's something we need to talk about, and I plan to bring it up,"
Joharin said, stepping forward, trying to calm the situation.
"But I don't know if this is the best time. We have other things to discuss first."
"I don't know why we have to talk about them at all," the woman retorted.
"I think it's important, if only for our own safety," Joharin said. "If they are intelligent people, and Ayla and Jondalar have nearly convinced me they are, and we have been treating them like animals, why haven't they objected?"
Probably because they are animals, the woman said.
Ayla says it's because they choose to avoid us, Joharan said, and for the most part we avoid them. But if we think of them only as animals, perhaps not hunting them, but claiming all the land as ours, as Zelindanyi territory, hunting grounds, gathering fields, everything, what if they start resisting? And what should we do if they decide to change and start to claim some of it for themselves? I think we need to be prepared. At least we ought to talk about the possibility.
I think you are making too much of it, Joharan. If Flatheads haven't made claims to territory before, why should they start now?
Zelindani of the 14th said, dismissing the entire concept.
But they do make claims to territory,
Jondalar said.
On the other side of the glacier, the Los Adunai understand that the land north of the Mother River is Flathead country. They stay south, except for some young ruffians who've been stirring up trouble, and I'm afraid the clan won't put up with it much longer, especially the younger ones.
What makes you say that?
Joharan said. You never mentioned this before.
Shortly after we started out, when Thonalan and I got down off the other side of the glacier over the highland to the east, we met up with a band of Flatheads, men of the clan, probably a hunting party,
Jondalar said,
and had a small confrontation.
What kind of confrontation?
Joharan asked. Everyone else was paying close attention, too.
A young one threw a stone at us, I think because we were on their side of the river, in their territory. Thonalan threw a spear back when he saw someone moving in the woods where they were hiding. Suddenly they all stepped forward and showed themselves. Two of us against several of them. The odds were not good. To tell you the truth, I don't think the odds would be good one-on-one. They may be short, but they are powerful. I wasn't at all sure how to get out of it. It was their leader who resolved it.
How could you tell they had a leader? And even if they did, how do you know they weren't just a pack, like wolves?
Another man asked. Jondalar thought he recognized him, but wasn't sure. He had been gone 5 years, after all.
Now I know for sure. I've met others since. But even then it was obvious. He told the youngster who had thrown the stone to return Thonalan's spear and retrieve the stone. Then they slipped back into the woods,
Jondalar said.
He put everything back the way it was and thought that settled it. Since no one was hurt, I guess it did.
Told the youngster? Flatheads can't talk, the man said.
In fact, they can, Jondalar said. They just don't talk like we do. They use hand signs mostly. I've learned some of them, and I've communicated with them, but Ayla is much better. She knows their language.
I find that hard to believe,
Zelindani of the 14th said.
Jondalar smiled. I did it first, too, he said. I never saw one up close before that encounter. Have you?
No, I can't say that I have, and I have no desire to, the woman said. I understand they rather resemble bears.
They don't resemble bears any more than we do. They look like people, a different kind of people, but there is no mistaking them. That hunting party was carrying spears and wearing clothes. Did you ever see bears do that?
Jondalar asked.
So they are clever bears, she said.
Don't underestimate them. They're not bears or any other kind of animal. They are people. Intelligent people,
Jondalar said.
You said you communicated with them. When?
Asked the man Jondalar couldn't quite place.
Once, when we were staying with the Shiramidoi, I got into trouble on the Great Mother River. The Shiramidoi lived beside her, not too far from the end where she empties into Barren Sea. When you first get down off the glacier, the mother is hardly a stream, but where they live she is huge, so wide in places she almost looks like a lake. But though she can seem placid and smooth, she has a deceptively deep, swift, and strong current. But then so many other rivers, large and small, have flowed into her that when you see her from the home of the Shiramidoi, you know why she's called the Great Mother River.
Jondalar was getting into storytelling mode, and people were listening with rapt attention.
The Sharamadoi make excellent watercraft out of huge logs that are dug out and shaped to make a shell with pointed ends. I was practicing to control a small dugout boat using a paddle when I lost control.
Jandalar made a deprecating smile that showed his chagrin.
To be honest, I was showing off a little. They usually keep a line with one end attached to the boat and a hook with bait ready all the time in their boats, and I wanted to prove to them that I could catch a fish. The trouble is, fish in a river that big match its size, especially sturgeon. The rivermen don't call it fishing when they go after the big ones. They say they're hunting sturgeon.
"I once saw a salmon nearly as big as a man," someone called out.
"Some sturgeon near the end of the Great Mother River are bigger than the length of three tall men,"
Jandalar said.
"When I noticed the fishing gear, I threw out a line, but I was not lucky. I caught one, or rather a big sturgeon caught me, because the line was fastened to the boat. When that fish started swimming, he took me with him. I lost the paddles and had no control. I reached for my knife to cut the line, but the boat hit something and knocked it out of my hand. The fish was strong and fast. He tried to dive and almost swamped me a couple of times. All I could do was hang on while that sturgeon pulled me upriver."
"What did you do?
How far did you go?
How did you stop it?"
voices called out.
"It turned out that the hook did injure the fish and was causing it to bleed. It finally wore him out. But by then he had dragged me across a wide part of the river and quite a ways upstream. When he gave up the fight, we happened to be in the arm of a little backwater shoal. I got out and swam to land, grateful to feel something solid under my feet."
"It's a good story, Jandalar, but what does it have to do with flatheads?"
Zelandani of the 14th said. He smiled at her, giving her all his attention.
"I was just getting to that part. I was on land, but I was soaked and shivering with cold. I didn't have a knife to cut wood. I didn't have anything to make fire. Most of the wood on the ground was wet, and I was really getting chilled. Suddenly, standing in front of me was this flathead. He had just the start of a beard, so he couldn't have been very old. He beckoned me to follow him, though I wasn't sure what he meant at first. Then I noticed smoke in the direction he was going, so I followed him, and he led me to a fire,"
Jandalar said.
"Weren't you afraid to go with him? You didn't know what he might do,"
another voice called out. More people were joining them, Jandalar noticed. Ayla had been aware of the gathering crowd, too.
"By then I was so cold I didn't care. All I wanted was that fire. I squatted down, getting as close as I could to it. Then I felt a fur being laid across my shoulders. I looked up and saw a woman. When she saw me, she ducked behind a bush and hid, and though I tried, I couldn't see her. From the glimpse I got of her, I think she was older, maybe the young man's mother. When I finally warmed up,"
Jandalar continued,
"he led me back to the boat and the fish, belly up near the bank. It wasn't the biggest sturgeon I ever saw, but it wasn't small, at least the length of two men. The young clan man took out a knife and cut that fish in half, lengthwise. He made some motions to me which I didn't understand at the time, then wrapped up half that fish in a hide, flung it over his shoulder, and carried it off. Just about then, Thonalan and some rivermen came paddling upstream and found me. They had seen me being pulled upriver and came looking for me. When I told them about the young flathead, just like you, Zelandani of the 14th, they didn't want to believe me, but then they saw the half-fish that was left. Those men never stopped teasing me about going fishing and only getting half a fish, but it took three of them to drag the other half-fish into the boat, and that young flathead picked it up and carried it away alone."
"Well, that's a good fish story, Jandalar," Zelandani of the 14th said.
Jandalar looked at her directly, with the full intensity of his amazing blue eyes.
"I know it sounds like a fish story, but I promise you it's true. Every word,"
he said with earnest sincerity. Then he shrugged and smiled, adding,
"But I can't blame you for doubting." I got a bad cold after that dunking, he continued, and while I was in bed staying warm by a fire, I had time to think about Flatheads. That young man probably saved my life. At least he knew I was cold and needed warmth. He may have been just as afraid of me as I was of him, but he gave me what I needed, and in exchange took half my fish. The first time I saw Flatheads, I was surprised that they carried spears and wore clothes. After meeting that young man and his mother, I knew they used fire and had sharp knives and were very strong, but more than that, he was smart. He understood I was cold, and he helped me, and for that, he thought he had a right to a share of my catch. I would have given him the whole thing, and I think he could have hauled it off, too. But he didn't take it all. He shared it.
That is interesting, the woman said, smiling at Jandalar. The unintentional charm and charisma of the decidedly handsome man was beginning to make an impression on the older woman, which was not lost on the one who was first. She would remember it for the future. If she could use Jandalar to ease her relationship with Zelandani of the 14th, she wouldn't hesitate. The woman had been like a canebrake of sharp thorns ever since she was selected to be first, impeding every decision and obstructing every policy she tried to make.
I could tell you about the boy of mixed spirits that was adopted by the mate of the Mamutoi headman of the Lion Camp, because that was when I learned some of their signs, Jandalar continued. But I think telling about the man and woman we met just before we started back across the glacier would be more significant, because they live close.
I think you should wait with that story, Jandalar, said Marthona, who had joined them. It should be told to more people, and this meeting is to make decisions about the matrimonial, that is, if no one objects, she added, looking directly at Zelandani of the 14th Cave and smiling sweetly. She, too, had seen the effect of her captivating son on the older woman, and she was more than aware of the problems the 14th had given the first. She had been a leader herself and understood.
"Unless you're really interested in hearing all the discussion and details," Joharan said to Jandalar and Ayla, "this might be a good time to look for a place to demonstrate your spear-thrower. I'd like you to do it before the first hunt."
Ayla wouldn't have minded staying. She wanted to learn as much as she could about Jandalar's, and now her, people, but he was eager to follow up on the suggestion. He wanted to share his new hunting weapon with all the Zelandani. They explored the campsite of the summer meeting, Jandalar greeting friends and introducing Ayla. They found themselves the object of attention because of Wolf, but they expected it. Ayla wanted to get the initial disturbance over with as soon as possible. The sooner people started getting used to seeing the animals, the sooner they would begin to take them for granted. They decided on an area that they thought would work for the spear-thrower demonstration. Then they saw one of the young men who had helped hold up the travois when they crossed rivers to keep the goods they were transporting dry. He was from Three Rocks, the west holding of the 29th Cave, also known as Summer Camp, and had traveled with them the rest of the way. They chatted a while when his mother came along and invited them to have a meal with them. The sun was already high, and they hadn't eaten since early in the day, and gratefully accepted. Even Wolf was given a bone with some meat on it. They were extended a special invitation to help with the pine nut harvest in the fall. On their way back to their camp, they passed by the large lodge of the Zelandania. The first was just coming out, and stopped to tell them that all the people who were involved with the first matrimonial that she had spoken with so far were willing to delay the ceremony until the arrival of Dalinar and the Lanzadanyi. They were introduced to several of the other Zelandania, and the people from the 9th Cave observed with interest their various reactions to the wolf. By the time they started back to the camp of the 9th Cave, the sun was dropping over the horizon in a blaze of gold, coruscating in resplendent beams through red clouds. When they reached the bank of the river, flowing smoothly with hardly a ripple at that point, they continued upstream until they crossed the small creek that joined it. They stopped for a moment to watch the evening sky transform itself in a show of dazzling radiance as gold transmuted into shades of vermilion that waned into shimmering purple, then darkened to deep blue as the first glittering sky fires appeared. Soon the sooty black night became a backdrop to the multitude of blazing lights that filled the summer sky, with a concentrated accumulation wending its way like a path across the vault above. Ayla recalled the line from the mother's song, "The mother's hot milk laid a path through the sky." Is that how it was made, she wondered, as they turned toward the welcoming fires of their nearby camp. When Ayla awoke the next morning, everyone else seemed to be up and gone already, and she was feeling uncharacteristically lazy. Her eyes were accustomed to the dim light inside the dwelling, and she lay in her sleeping roll, looking at the designs carved and painted on the sturdy wooden center pole and the smudges of soot that already blackened the edges of the smoke hole, until she had to pass water. She felt the need even more often lately. She didn't know where the community waste trenches had been dug, so she used the night basket. She wasn't the only one who had used it, she noticed. I'll empty it later, she thought. It was one of the unpleasant chores that were shared by those who felt it was a duty, and those who were shamed into it if it was noticed that they hadn't recently. When she walked back to her sleeping roll to shake it out, she looked more closely around the inside of the summer camp shelter. She had been surprised at the structures that had been made while she and Jandalar were visiting the day before. Though she had noticed the lodges of the people who had set up their camps near the main area, she was still expecting to see the traveling tents, but most people did not use the tents they had traveled with at the summer meeting camp. During the warm season, the traveling tents would be used by various people for temporary treks to hunt or gather produce, or visit as they ranged over their territory. The summer lodge was a more permanent structure, a circular, straight-sided, rather substantial dwelling. Though made differently, Ayla understood they were similar in purpose to the lodges used by the Mamutoi during their summer meetings. Though it was dark inside, the only light came from the open entrance and an occasional sliver of sunlight that found its way through cracks in the wall where pieces joined. Ayla saw that, besides the center pole of pine, the dwelling had an interior wall of panels woven out of flattened bulrush stems and painted with designs and animals. They were attached to the inside of poles that encircled the center pole and provided a fairly large enclosed space that could be left open or divided into smaller areas with movable interior panels. The ground was covered with mats, which were made of bulrushes, tall phragmite reeds, cattail leaves or grasses, and sleeping rolls were spread out around a slightly off-center fireplace. The smoke escaped through a hole above it near the center pole. A smoke hole cover could be adjusted from the inside with short poles that were attached to it. She was curious about how the rest of the structure was made and stepped outside. First, she glanced around the camp, which was composed of several large circular lodges surrounding a central fireplace. And then she walked around the outside of the dwelling. Poles were lashed together in a way that was similar to the fence of the surround that was erected to capture animals. But instead of the freestanding, flexible construction that could yield when an animal bumped or butted into it, the summer lodge fencing was attached to widely spaced anchoring poles of alder that were sunk into the ground. A wall of sturdy vertical panels made of overlapped cattail leaves, which shed rain, was attached to the outside of the poles, leaving an air space between the outer and inner walls for extra insulation to make it cooler on hot days and, with a fire inside, warmer on cool nights. It also avoided accumulation of moisture condensation on the inside when it was cold out. The roof was a fairly thick thatch of overlapping reeds that sloped down from the center pole. The thatch was not particularly well made, but it kept the rain out and was required only for a season. Parts of the lodge were brought with them, in particular the woven mats, panels, interior walls, and some of the poles. Generally, each person who was sharing a dwelling carried some sections or pieces, but much of the material was gathered fresh from the surrounding area each year. When they returned home in the fall, the structures were partially dismantled to retrieve the reusable parts, but left standing. They seldom lasted through the heavy snows and winds of winter, and by the following summer there were only collapsed ruins, which disintegrated back into the environment before the same location was used again for a summer meeting. Ayla remembered that the Mamutoi had different names for their summer camps than they did for their winter dwellings. The lion camp, for example, was the cattail camp at the summer meeting, but the same people who lived at lion camp lived there. She asked Jandalar if the ninth cave had a different summer name. He explained that their location was just called the Camp of the Ninth Cave, but living arrangements at Zelandanyi's summer meetings were not quite the same as they were in winter in the shelters of stone. Each summer dwelling accommodated more people than usually shared the roomier, more permanent structures under the large overhang of the Ninth Cave. As a rule, family members, including those who had separate dwellings in winter, shared a lodge. But some people didn't even stay at the same camp. Instead, it was not uncommon for some to spend the summer with other relatives or friends. For example, young matrons who had moved to their mates' caves often liked to take their children and spend the summer with their mothers, siblings, or childhood friends, and their mates usually accompanied them. In addition, young women who would be having their first rites that year lived together in a separate dwelling near the large central dwelling of the Zelandanya, at least for the first part of the summer. Another dwelling nearby was set up for the women who chose to be Danyi women that year, to be available for the young men who were approaching puberty. Most young men who were past puberty, and some men not so young, often chose to band together separately away from their home camps and set up lodges of their own. They were required to be on the periphery of the camp, as far away as possible from the very desirable young women who were being prepared for first rites. For the most part, the men didn't mind. They would have liked to ogle the women, but they rather liked the privacy of being off by themselves, so no one could complain if they were a little loud or rowdy. As a consequence, the men's dwellings were called the Far Lodges, usually shortened to phalages. The men who stayed in a phalage were usually unmated or between mates, or wished they were. Since he didn't rush to greet her when she went out, Ayla assumed that Wolf was with Jandalar. There were not many people outside. Most were probably somewhere around the central area, the main focus of the summer meeting, but she found some leftover tea near the camp's fireplace. She noticed that the fireplace was not shaped like a big round bonfire, but more like a trench. She had seen the evening before that more people could get closer to a fire if it was extended and longer logs and branches, cut down or deadfall, could be used without having to hack them into smaller pieces. While she was drinking the tea, Salova, Rushamar's mate, came out of her lodge, holding her baby daughter.
"Greetings, Ayla," she said, putting her baby down on a mat.
"Greetings, Salova," Ayla said, coming closer to see the baby. She held out a finger for the infant to grab and smiled at her. Salova looked at Ayla, hesitated, then asked,
"Would you mind watching Marsola for a while? I gathered some materials to make baskets and have some of them soaking in the creek. I'd like to get them and sort them out. I promised some people I would make baskets for them."
"I'd love to watch Marsola," Ayla said, smiling at her, then turned back to the baby. Salova was a little anxious around the foreign woman and kept up a nervous chatter.
"I just fed her, so she shouldn't be any trouble. I've got plenty of milk. Giving a little to Lorela isn't any trouble at all. Lenoka brought her around last night. She's getting nice and plump and smiles now. She didn't used to smile at all."
"Oh, you haven't eaten yet, have you?
I have some soup left over from last night with some good pieces of deer meat in it. You're welcome to it if you want. It's what I ate this morning. It's probably still warm.
Thank you. I think I will have a little soup, Ayla said. I'll be right back, she said, then hurried away.
Ayla found the soup in a large auroch stomach container that had been mounted on a wood frame and placed over some hot coals at the edge of the long community fireplace to simmer. The coals had almost died, but the soup was still hot. A stack of odd bowls was nearby, some tightly woven, some carved out of wood, a couple of shallow ones shaped out of some large bone. A few used bowls were scattered around where people had left them.
Ayla scooped out some soup with a ladle made of a curved sheephorn, then took out her eating knife. She saw that there had been vegetables in it, too, though they were rather soft by now. She sat on the mat beside the baby, who was lying on her back, kicking her feet into the air. Some deer dew claws had been tied to one ankle, and they rattled whenever she kicked up her feet. Ayla finished her soup, then picked up the baby, and, supporting her head with her hands, held her so that she was looking at her. When Solova came back with a wide, flat basket full of various fibrous vegetation, she saw Ayla talking to her baby and making her smile. It warmed the young mother's heart and made her feel more relaxed around the stranger.
I really appreciate your watching her, Ayla. It gave me a chance to get this ready, Solova said. It was my pleasure, Solova. Marsola is a wonderful baby. Did you know that Proliva's younger sister, Lavila, is getting mated at the first matrimonial, just like you? You always feel a special tie to the people who mate at the same matrimonial as you, Solova said. Proliva wanted me to make some special baskets for her as part of her matrimonial gift. Would you mind if I watched you for a little while? I've made baskets, but I'd like to know how you make them, Ayla said. I don't mind at all. I'd like the company, and maybe you can show me how you do it. I always like to learn new ways, Solova said.
The two young women sat together, talking and comparing basket-making techniques, while the baby slept beside them. Ayla liked the way Solova used materials of different colors and actually wove pictures of animals and various designs into her containers. Solova thought Ayla's subtle techniques that created different textures gave a rich elegance to her seemingly simple baskets. Each gained an appreciation for the other's skill and for each other. After a while, Ayla got up.
I'm going to have to use the trenches. Can you tell me where they are? I should empty the night basket, too, and I might as well wash these bowls, she added, picking up the used ones that were scattered around. And then I should go check on the horses.
The trenches are over there, Solova said, pointing in a direction away from the creek and the camp. And we've been washing the cooking and eating things at the end of the creek, where it empties into the river. There's some clean sand for scouring nearby. I don't have to tell you where the horses are, she smiled then. I went to look at the horses yesterday with Rushamar. They made me nervous at first, but they seemed gentle and content. The mare ate some grass out of my hand.
Her smile turned to a grin and then to a worried frown.
I hope that was all right. Rushamar said Jondalar told him it would be.
Of course it's all right. It makes them more comfortable if they get to know the people around them, Ayla said.
She's not so strange, Solova thought as she watched Ayla go. She talks a little funny, but she's really nice. I wonder whatever made her think that she could make those animals do what she wanted them to. I never even imagined that one day I would feed a horse some grass out of my own hand. After cleaning up the bowls and stacking them near the fire trench, Ayla thought it might be nice to clean herself up and go for a swim. She went back to their lodge, smiled at Solova and the baby, and slipped inside. She took the soft, drying hide out of her traveling pack and then looked over her clothing. She didn't have much, but it was more than she came with. Though she had cleaned them, she did not want to wear the worn and stained clothes she had worn on her long journey, except as working clothes.
The clothes she had worn on the recent trek to the summer meeting were the ones she had saved to wear when she met Jandalar's people, but even they were well-worn and had their share of stains. She also had the boys' winter underwear that Marona and her friends had given her, but she knew that wouldn't be appropriate. Of course, she had her matrimonial outfit, but that would be saved, as would the beautiful outfit that Marthona had given to her for special occasions. What was left were a few things of theirs that Marthona and Falara had given her. They were unfamiliar to her, but she thought they might be suitable. Before she left the lodge, she noticed her riding blanket folded up near her sleeping roll and decided to take it as well. Then she went to see the horses. Whinny and Racer were both glad to see her and crowded close to get her attention. Both wore halters with a long lead attached to a sturdy tree. She removed them and put them in her pack. Then she tied the riding blanket on Whinny, mounted her, and started upstream. The horses were in high spirits and broke out at a fast run, happy for the freedom. Their feeling was communicated to Ayla, who let them set their own pace. She was particularly pleased when she reached the meadow near the pool to see Wolf racing toward them. That had to mean Jandalar was nearby. Sometime after Ayla left, Joharan came to the camp and asked Salova if she had seen Ayla. "Yes, we were making baskets together," she said. "The last time I saw her, she was heading toward the horses. She said she needed to check on them."
"I'll go look for her. But if you see her, will you tell her Zelandani wants to talk to her?"
"Of course," Salova said, wondering what the Danyar wanted.
Then she shrugged. No one was likely to tell her what the First wanted.
Ayla saw Jandalar step out from behind some brush with a surprised grin on his face. She pulled to a stop, slid down, and raced into his arms.
"What are you doing here?"
he asked after their warm embrace.
"I didn't even tell anybody I was coming here. I was just walking upstream, and when I got this far, I remembered that scree slope behind the pool and thought I'd check to see if there was any flint."
"Is there?"
"Yes, not the best quality, but serviceable. What made you decide to come here?"
"I woke up feeling lazy. Hardly anyone was around except Salova and her baby. She asked me to watch Marsola when she went to get her materials to make baskets. She's such a wonderful baby, Jandalar. We talked for a while and did some basket weaving. Then I decided to come for a swim and take the horses for a run, and found you. What a nice surprise," she said, smiling.
"A nice surprise for me, too. Maybe I'll take a swim with you. I'm pretty dusty from hauling rocks around, but first I should get the stones I found and bring them here." "Then we'll see," he said with an inviting grin. He gave her a slow, lingering kiss. "Maybe I can worry about those rocks later."
"Go ahead and get them so you won't have to clean the dust off twice. I wanted to wash my hair anyway. It was a long, sweaty trek getting here," Ayla said.
When Joharan reached the place where the horses had been, it was obvious they were gone.
"They've probably gone for one of their long rides," he thought, "and Zelandani really wanted to see Ayla. Willemar wanted to talk to them, too. Jandalar knows they'll have plenty of time to themselves after the matrimonial. You'd think he would realize that there are important issues to settle at the beginning of a summer meeting," Joharan thought, a little irritated that he couldn't find them. He had not been all that pleased that he was the one the Danyar happened to see when she was looking for someone to send for them. After all, he had more important things to do than chase after his brother, but he didn't feel he could exactly refuse Zelandani, at least not without a very good excuse. He glanced down and saw the fresh tracks of the horses. He was too experienced a tracker not to notice the direction they had taken, and he knew they had not headed off away from camp. It looked as if they were following the creek upstream. He recalled the pleasing little glen at the head of the small waterway with a spring-fed pond and the grassy meadow. That's probably where they went, he thought, smiling to himself. Since he had been sent on a mission to find them, he didn't like returning without them.
He followed the creek, checking the tracks as he went to make sure they hadn't veered off, and when he saw the horses ahead, grazing contentedly, he knew he'd found them. When he reached the screen of hazelnut shrubs, some as tall as trees, he peered through, and seeing only Ayla, wondered where his brother was. When he reached the sandy bank, she was just ducking under the water, and he called to her when she came up for air.
"Ayla, I've been looking for you."
Ayla pushed back her hair and rubbed her eyes.
"Oh, Joharan, it's you,"
she said, in a tone of voice he couldn't quite identify.
"Do you know where Jandalar is?"
"Yes. He was looking for flint in the rock pile behind the pond and went to get the stones he found. Then he was going to come and bathe with me,"
Ayla said, seeming a little disconcerted.
"Zelandani wants to see you, and Willemar wanted to talk to you both,"
Joharan said.
"Oh,"
she said, sounding rather disappointed. Joharan had often seen women without clothes on. Most of them bathed in the river every morning in the summer and washed themselves in winter. Nakedness by itself was not considered especially suggestive. Women wore special clothing or accoutrements that were meant to be inviting when they wanted to show interest in a man, or behaved in certain ways, especially at a festival, to honor the mother. But as Ayla started out of the water, it occurred to him that she and his brother had had other plans which he'd interrupted. The thought made him aware of her body as she approached him, walking out of the water. She was tall, with shapely curves and well-defined muscles. Her large breasts still had the firmness of a young woman, and he'd always found a woman with a slightly rounded stomach appealing. Morona has always been considered the beauty of the bunch, he thought. No wonder she took such a dislike to Ayla from the beginning. She looked good in that winter underwear she got tricked into wearing, but that was nothing compared to really seeing her. Morona doesn't compare. My brother is a lucky man, he thought. Ayla is a fine-looking woman, but she's going to get a lot of attention at mother festivals, and I'm not sure how Jandalar will like that. Ayla was looking at him with a puzzled expression, and it made Joharan realize that he'd been staring. He flushed slightly and looked away, and saw his brother coming, carrying a heavy load of stones. He went to help him.
"What are you doing here?"
Jandalar said.
"Zelandani wants to talk to Ayla, and Willemar would like to talk to both of you,"
Joharan said.
"What does Zelandani want? Can't it wait?"
Jandalar said.
"She didn't seem to think so. Chasing down my brother and his promised is not the way I planned to spend the day either." "Don't worry, Jandalar,"
Joharan said with a conspiratorial grin.
"You'll just have to wait a while. And she's worth waiting for, isn't she?"
Jandalar started to make protests and denials of his innuendos. Then he relaxed and smiled.
"I waited a long time to find her," he said. "Well, now that you're here, you can help me carry these stones back. I did want to take a swim and clean up a little. Why don't you leave the stones here for now? They won't go away, and then you'll have an excuse to come back later," Joharan said. "And I'm sure you'll have time for a swim, if that's all you do."
It was near midday by the time Ayla and Jandalar and Wolf found their way to the main camp area, and from their air of relaxed contentment, Joharan suspected they had found time for more than a quick swim after he left. He'd told Zelandani he had found them and passed on her message, and he had encouraged his brother to hurry. It wasn't his fault if Jandalar dallied, not that he could blame him. Several people from the Ninth Cave had gathered around the long cooking hearth near the Zelandanya Lodge, and just as Ayla was approaching the entrance to let the Danyar know she was there, the large woman who was first came out, followed by several others, with the distinctive tattoos on their foreheads of those who served the mother.
"There you are, Ayla," Zelandani said when she saw her. "I've been expecting you all morning."
"We were upstream from the camp when Joharan found us. There is a nice spring-fed pond there. I wanted to give the horses a run and brush their coats. They get nervous around so many people until they get used to them. And brushing calms them, and I wanted to take a swim and clean up after the trek here, Ayla said. Everything she said was entirely true, though it may not have included all of her activities. The Danya regarded her, clean and dressed in the Zelandanyi clothing that Marthona had given to her. Then she saw Jandalar, also looking fresh and clean, and raised her eyebrows in a knowing look. Joharan was watching the one who was first and the woman his brother had brought home with him, and realized that Zelandani had a pretty good idea what had delayed them, and that Ayla didn't seem to care that she hadn't rushed. The large woman had an authoritative bearing, and he knew she intimidated many, but she didn't seem to daunt the stranger. "We were just stopping for a meal," Zelandani said, walking toward the large cooking hearth, compelling Ayla to fall in beside her. "Proliva has organized the preparation and just informed us it was ready. You might as well join us. It will give me a chance to talk to you. Do you have one of your firestones?"
"Yes, I always keep a fire-making kit with me," Ayla said.
"I would like you to demonstrate your new fire-making technique to the Zelandanya. I think it should be introduced to the people, but it is important that it be shown in the right way, with appropriate ritual."
"I didn't need a ritual to show it to Marthona or you. It's not that difficult once you see how it's done," Ayla said.
"No, it's not difficult. But it is a new and powerful technique, and that can be disturbing, especially for those people who don't accept change easily and resist it," the Danya said.
"You must know people like that."
Ayla thought of the clan with their lives based on tradition, their reluctance to change, and their inability to cope with new ideas.
"Yes, I know people like that," she said. "But the people I've met recently seem to enjoy learning new things."
All the others she had met seemed to adapt so easily to changes in their lives, to thrive on innovation. She hadn't realized that there might be some who were not comfortable with a different way of doing things, who actually resisted it. It gave her a sudden insight, and she frowned at the thought. That could explain certain attitudes and incidents that had puzzled her, such as why some people seemed so unwilling to accept the idea that the clan were people. Like that Zelandani, the one from the 14th cave who kept calling them animals. Even after Jandalar explained, she acted as if she didn't believe him. I think she didn't want to change her opinion, Ayla thought.
It is true. Most people do like to learn a better or quicker way of doing something, but sometimes it depends upon how it's presented, the first said. For example, Jandalar has been away for a long time. He matured while he was gone and learned many new things, but the people he knows weren't there to see it, so some of them still think of him the way he was when he left. Now he has returned, and he's eager to share what he's learned and discovered, which is commendable. But he didn't learn everything all at once. Even his new weapon, which is a valuable tool for hunting, takes practice to use. Those who've been successful and are comfortable with the weapons they know may not be willing to put forth the effort it will take to learn the new one, though I have no doubt it will be used by all hunters one day.
"Yes, the spear thrower does take practice," Ayla said. "We know it now, but in the beginning we worked at it."
"And that is only one thing," the Danya continued, while she picked up a plate made from the shoulder bone of a deer and put some slices of meat on it.
"What kind of meat is it?"
she asked a woman who was standing nearby.
"That's mammoth. Some hunters from the 19th cave went north on a hunting trek and got a mammoth. They decided to share some. I understand they got a woolly rhinoceros, too."
"I haven't had mammoth for a long time," Zelandani said. "I'm going to relish this."
"Have you tasted mammoth?" the woman asked Ayla.
"Yes," she said. "The Mamutoi, the people I lived with before, are known as mammoth hunters, although they hunted other animals, too. But it's been some time since I've had any. I, too, will enjoy this."
Zelandani thought about introducing Ayla to the woman,
but once she started, there would be no end, and she still wanted to talk to her about a ceremony using the Firestone. She turned back to Ayla while she added some round white roots and ground nuts to her plate, and cooked greens, nettles, she thought, mixed with pieces of brown-capped, spongy boletus mushroom.
Jondalar also brought you and your animals, Ayla. You must know how astonishing that is. People have hunted horses and observed them with other horses, but they've never seen horses behave as yours do. It's frightening at first to see those horses go where you want them to, or that this wolf will walk through a camp full of people and do what you tell him, she said, specifically acknowledging Wolf for the first time, though she had certainly seen him. He yipped a small bark when she looked at him. It was a custom the wolf and the woman had developed that rather surprised Ayla. Zelandani didn't always acknowledge Wolf when she saw him, and he ignored her until she did. But when she did, he responded with a short yip. She seldom touched him, except for a pat on the head now and then. But on rare occasions, Wolf would take her hand in his teeth, never leaving any tooth marks. She always allowed it, saying only that they understood each other. It seemed to Ayla that they did, in their own way. "I know you say that anyone could do it if one starts with a young animal, and that may be true, but people don't know that. They can only see it as something not natural to this world, so it must come from another world, from the spirit world. I am frankly amazed at how well they've accepted the animals, but it is an uneasy acceptance. It will take time. And now we want to show them something else you've brought that no one else has seen before. People don't know you yet, Ayla. I'm sure people will want to use the Firestone once they've seen how it works, but they may be afraid of it. I think it has to be seen as a gift from the mother, which can be done if it is first understood and accepted by the Zelandanya and presented with the proper ritual, the Danya said. The way she explained it seemed entirely logical, but in a quiet space in her own mind, it made Ayla realize how persuasive Zelandani could be.
"When you explain it like that, I understand," Ayla said. "Of course I will show the Zelandanya how the Firestone works, and help you with whatever ritual you feel is necessary."
They joined Jondalar's family and some of the people from the Ninth Cave, who were sitting with a few people from other caves. After the meal, Zelandani took Ayla aside.
"Can you leave the wolf outside the lodge for a while? I think it's important to concentrate on the fire-making, and I'm afraid Wolf would be a distraction," she said.
"I'm sure Jondalar won't mind keeping him," Ayla said, turning to look at him.
He nodded, and when she got up to leave, she told Wolf to stay with him, making hand signs as well, though they were not noticed by most people. The midday sun had been bright, which made the inside of the Zelandanya lodge seem dark, even though many lamps were lit. Her eyes adjusted quickly, but when the first stood up to begin speaking, the Zelandani of the 14th cave objected.
"Why is she here?" the 14th said. "She may be a Zelandanyi woman, but she is not Zelandanya. She's an outsider and does not belong at this meeting."
Chapter 24. The one who was first among those who served the mother repressed a sigh of frustration. She was not going to make any obvious display of her irritation and let the tall, thin Zelandani of the 14th cave have the satisfaction of knowing how much she annoyed her. But the question brought frowns and disapproving looks from some of the other Zelandanya, and a smirk from the acolyte of the 5th cave with the missing front teeth.
"You are right, Zelandani of the 14th," the first said. "Outsiders, those who are not part of the Zelandanya, are not usually invited to these meetings. This is a gathering of those who have had some experience with the world of the spirits, the ones who have been called, and the acolytes, who have shown promise and are in training. That's why I've invited Ayla. You know that she's a healer, She was a great help to Chevenar, the man who was trampled when that bison bolted during the last community hunt, the Danyer said.
Chevenar died, and I don't know how much help she was. I didn't examine him, the 14th said. There are many who have some knowledge of certain medicinals. Almost everyone knows about willow bark and its ability to stop the pain of minor aches, for example.
I assure you that she knows a great deal more than the uses of willow bark, the one who was first said. One of her names and ties from her previous people is Daughter of the Mammoth Hearth. The Mammoth Hearth of the Mamutoi is the same as the Zelandanya. They are those who serve the Mother.
Are you saying she's a Zelandani of the Mamutoi? Where is her tattoo?
The question was asked by an elderly woman with white hair and intelligent eyes.
Her tattoo, Zelandani of the 19th?
The large woman asked and thought, what did the 19th know that she didn't? She was an experienced and reliable Zelandani who had learned a great deal in her long life. It was a shame she'd been having so much trouble with arthritis during the past years. The time was drawing near when she would not be able to walk to the summer meetings. If this meeting were not near the 19th cave, she might not have made it this year.
I know of the Mamutoi. Jerrica of the Lanzadanyi lived with them for a while when she was young and still traveling with her mother and the man of her hearth on their long journey. One summer, many years ago, when she was pregnant with Joplea, she was having some trouble and I attended her. She told me about the Mamutoi. Their Danyers are also marked with tattoos on their faces, though not quite like ours. But if Ayla is the same as a Zelandani, where is her tattoo?
She was in training, but not fully trained, when she left to come here with Jandalar. She's not the same as a Zelandani. She's more like an acolyte, but with more knowledge of healing than most. In addition, she was adopted to the Mammoth Hearth by the Mammut who was first, because he saw her potential, the first said.
Are you sponsoring her to become an acolyte of the Zelandanya?
The 19th asked. Though they seldom spoke out, there were a few quiet murmurs from the acolytes in attendance.
Not at this time. I haven't yet asked her if she wants to further her training.
Ayla felt a touch of consternation. Though she would not mind talking about healing with some of them, she had no desire to become a Zelandani. She just wanted to mate with Jandalar and have children. And she noticed that few of the Zelandanya had mates or children. It wasn't that they couldn't mate if they chose, but it seemed that there were so many other demands on their time and attention when they were in the service of the Great Earth Mother that they didn't have time to be mothers themselves.
Then why is she here? The 14th asked.
Her wispy gray hair had pulled loose from the small bun on the back of her head, more on one side than the other, giving her a careless, disheveled appearance. If someone were kind, they would tactfully suggest that she fix her hair before she went out, but the first wouldn't dream of it. The contentious Zelandani would take anything she said as criticism.
I asked her to come because I would like her to show you something that I think you would find very interesting.
Is it about those animals she controls?
Asked another Danyer. The first smiled. At least someone was willing to admit that Ayla had some unusual skills that might be worthy of the Zelandanya.
No, Zelandani of the South Holding of the 29th Cave. That might be cause for another meeting, but this time she has something else for you to see.
Though the South Holding 29th was an assistant to the primary Zelandani of the 29th, it was only in terms of speaking for all of Three Rocks. He was a full-fledged Zelandani in his own right, and the first knew him to be a good healer. He had the same right to speak out as any other Danyer. Ayla noticed that the one who was first addressed the members of the Zelandanya by their full titles, which were sometimes quite long, since they included the counting words of their caves, but sounded very formal and important.
Then it occurred to her that the only way to differentiate among them was by the counting words. They had given up their personal names and were all Zelandani. They had, she realized, exchanged their names for counting words. When she lived in her valley, she had scratched a mark on a stick every day she was there. By the time Jandalar arrived, she had a bundle of sticks full of marks. When he used the counting words to tally the cut marks and was then able to tell her how long she had lived in her valley, it had seemed to her magic that was so powerful it was almost frightening. When he taught them to her, she had sensed that counting words were very important and highly valued by the Zelandani. Now she realized that, at least among those who served the mother, they were more important than names, and their use by the Zelandana gave them the essence of those powerful symbols. The first beckoned to Jonakol. "First acolyte of the ninth cave, will you use the sand I asked you to get and put out the fire? And, first acolyte of the second cave, will you put out all the lamps?" Ayla recognized the two acolytes the first had called upon for assistance. They had guided her when she visited the deep cave with the animals painted on the walls at Fountain Rocks. She heard comments and questions of curiosity from the assembled group who knew the first was setting them up for something dramatic. Most of the older, experienced ones were preparing themselves to be critical. They knew and understood the techniques and impact of dramatic presentations and were determined not to be easily deluded by tricks or misdirection. When all the fires had been put out, there was still enough light to see from the occasional beams of sunlight that filtered in here and there. The lodge was not completely dark. Ayla looked around and noticed light seeping in, particularly around the outline of the entrance, though it was closed, and around another less obvious access, almost directly opposite it. Later, she thought, she might walk around the outside of the spacious Zelandania Lodge to find out if she could see the second opening. The first knew the demonstration would be much more impressive at night when the dark was total, but that didn't matter with the ones who were here. They would understand the possibilities immediately. "Would anyone like to come here and verify that the fire in this fireplace is completely out?" she said. The 14th quickly volunteered. She patted the sand carefully and dug her fingers in at a few warm spots, then stood up to announce, "The sand is dry, warm in a few places, but the fire is out and there are no hot coals."
"Ayla, will you tell me what you need to start a fire?"
the first said.
"I have most of it here," she said, taking out the fire-starting kit that she had used so often on her journey. "But tinder is necessary. Almost anything that catches fire quickly will work, fireweed fuzz or rotted wood from an old stump. If it's dry, and especially if it's pitchy, for example, then it's good to have some small kindling close by, and of course some larger pieces of wood."
There was a little buzz of noise, and the first picked up some words of irritation. They didn't need a lesson in fire-making, they were saying. Everyone knew how to make a fire from the time they were small children. Good, she thought, feeling rather pleased. Let them grumble. They only think they know all there is to making fire.
"Will you make a fire for us, Ayla?"
the Zelandani leader said. Ayla had fluffed up a small mound of fuzzy fireweed tops as tinder and had a piece of iron pyrite in her left hand and a flint striker in her right, but it wasn't obvious. She struck the firestone, saw a good spark land in the fluff of fireweed, blew it into life, and added kindling. In less time than it took to explain it, she had a fire going. There were some involuntary oohs and "how did she do that?" comments. Then the Zelandani of the third cave said, "Can you do it again?" Ayla smiled at the third. The older man had been so kind and supportive when she was trying to help Chevenar, she was pleased